Hello and welcome to a set of named London Theatre podcast for the 19th of November 2017. My name is TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about The Firm, which is at the Hampstead in their downstairs space. It's by Roy Williams and directed by Dennis Lawson. It has a cast that includes Delroy Atkinson, Clinton Blake, Simon Coombs, Jay Simpson and Clarence Smith. It is a play about a South London group of sort of football fans or people who use their football fandom, their fandom of Crystal Palace, to aid them in a sort of a gang, a firm, as it were. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought about it.
Well, I'm very fond of the work of Roy Williams because, for me, he's one of the very few playwrights, really, that's writing about contemporary urban life and, indeed, Black Lives in particular. So I think he's kind of occupying a space that few people occupy. And I've seen more than 10 of them. I think this might be the 11th, I haven't really counted. And he's never let me down, which I think is rare amongst playwrights. And he doesn't let you down here either, in my opinion. As you say, The Firm are a gang of sort of late 40s, early 50s, small-time crooks in southeast London. They're reuniting to celebrate the release of Sean from prison. And the reunion's taking place at the new bar owned by one of them, Gus, on the eve of his grand opening, so it hasn't quite opened yet. They come together. Selwyn, one of the gang, brings a young lad with him, ostensibly a relative of his, but we soon discover that he's already encountered two others. And Fraser is a sort of member of one of the new generation of gangs, or very different from this kind of lovable rogue gangs that constitutes The Firm, really. And Fraser comes with a proposition, but then, you know, that just takes us into an unravelling with lots of sort of ghosts and skeletons and truths coming out and myths, in fact, being debunked. So it sort of unfolds in that way, really. What Williams does so well is he writes very authentic and very ripe dialogue. And I thought, although this did start a little slowly, the story unfolded and unraveled with great pace. What I like most about it is it kind of showed you the very different ways the two generations of gangs, firms, operate, you know, how the world has changed and the new gangland is very different from the old gangland, as it were. And indeed also shows you the different personalities and motivations of the players and how they go their different ways. So you've got, you know, at one end you've got Gus, who's now seemingly a successful entrepreneur, and then you've got somebody else who's just, you know, a bit of a loser, really, and is kind of drifting a bit. I thought it was very well staged and very well designed. Alex Marker, the designer, is the Finbra's resident designer, so it sounds like he's relished getting his hands on a bigger budget, and he's created a very realistic sort of bar setting. And the cast was uniformly good. Clinton Blake, Jay Simpson, Delroy Atkinson, Clarence Smith were the members of the old firm, and then Simon Coombs as this younger character, Fraser. And I found it quite sort of visceral. It wasn't afraid to sort of expose shocking truths and let its hair down, really. So I actually kind of found it visceral, particularly in sort of close proximity in the theatre downstairs, which isn't somewhere I go to that often. But every time I go to it, I wonder why I don't go to it that often. And it's perhaps because it's a low profile, it's not reviewed, and you either have to take risks or you don't go, really. And I was kind of wondering why it is downstairs in the same way as I was wondering about The Kiss, Richard Bean's small-scale play last year sometime. You know, particularly when we talked about Slaves of Solitude, to me, this would have worked in the upstairs theatre and is a better play than The Slaves of Solitude. So although I'm not sure it's a better play for the Hampstead audience, which is more conservative of a certain age, but it's certainly the sort of play that's worthy of being on the size of stage that the upstairs theatre actually provides. So I enjoyed it very much. I was very glad I went.
Yeah, I agree. I was a little bit nonplussed when I saw it about why this isn't on a bigger stage, because it certainly deserves to be on a much bigger stage. And the slight worry is that it's not going to get a bigger stage if they do the normal so-called West End transfer, which is to transfer it into the small space at the Trafalgar Studios, which often counts as West End, and that's what happened to the Richard Bean play. This deserves a bigger audience and a bigger setting, a bigger stage, because it is a piece of quality and it's fascinating. And I was very surprised when you look at the people on board for this play. I mean, not just Roy Williams, who deserves to have his plays with, wide, as I say, a wide audience. It's also Des Lawson, who's no slouch as a director, and a very good cast. Yeah, it does start kind of slow and you do wonder where it's going to go, but it does work extremely well. I mean, it is done right through without an interval. I mean, it's pretty much a real-time play, I think. So everything is happening in real time on this play while they're waiting for somebody to come out of prison and come visit them, but maybe other things going on. But I was slightly nonplussed about why this isn't upstairs and why this isn't getting a wider audience, because it does deserve it, because it is very good. I think that maybe in comparison with some of his other work, it may not have been quite as showy and might not have been, you know, quite as visceral as some of his other plays. But I certainly think that in a place where you're not reviewing it, it kind of belongs beyond that. But one of the things about the Hampstead is that they've pointed out some of their difficulties, and they are sort of the fourth or fifth choice in some cases of when somebody is pitching a play. And perhaps this is a play that hasn't been taken on by some of the other bigger new writing houses in London, that they weren't prepared to take it on. Or perhaps the Hampstead has just been very lucky about snagging this, even though perhaps it's not getting the push that an upstairs play would have got to propel it into, as I say, a wider audience. And you wonder about some of the internal politics that might have gone on here. Because if you'd seen this at the Royal Court, this would be getting a lot of, you know, extremely positive reviews, I think. Or in the Dorfman, everybody would be saying what a great play this was. And maybe nobody's going to get to see the chance of it. I mean, I hope that they'll push it up into their upstairs space. But as you say, that's a slightly different audience. It isn't a risk-taking audience, which the downstairs space is at the Hampstead.
And the last time they had a Roy Williams play at Hampstead, Wildfire, which they put in the upstairs space, I mean, when I went, you could tell that the audience weren't enjoying it, that it wasn't their sort of thing at all. So I think that's the problem, you know. Is this the right theatre? I agree with you. This is a Royal Court play or a Dorfman play, or, you know, that's where it is, really. And I really hope, like you, it doesn't get buried because they've chosen to put it on in a reviewless space that fewer people hear about.
We're now going to talk about The Suppliant Women at the Young Vic. This is a play by the ancient Greek writer Aeschylus. It's part of a tetralogy, but only the first part of this tetralogy exists, and a speech from the final part of the tetralogy by, I think it's Aphrodite, on the need for marriage and the pleasures of marriage. This play has been translated in a very earthy, I think is the right word, translation by David Gregg. And it's directed by Ramin Gray for the Actors Touring Company and the Royal Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh. The cast includes Callum Armstrong, Oscar Batterham, Ben Burton, Omar Ibrahim and Gemma May Reese. But most of the cast are, I think, 24 young women from Lambeth and Southwark who have come together to form the chorus. Gemma May Reese acts as one of the chorus and kind of the chorus's leader, but they all get a part in it and they often solo off in different ways. We also have another chorus who come in later, also of people from Southwark and Lambeth, which are the two boroughs that the Young Vic more or less straddles. I think it's slightly on the Lambeth side more than on the Southwark side, but you're very, very close to Southwark. The play concerns a group of women, basically the granddaughters, I think, of Zeus, or the great-granddaughters of Zeus. Zeus fell in love with a young woman called Io. Hera transformed her into a cow, and Zeus transformed himself into a bull so he could have his wicked way. And Io fled to Egypt, had her calf, and was transformed back into human form. And that child then had two sons, and each of those sons had 50 children. One had all daughters and the other had all sons. And basically the sons want to marry the daughters don't want to marry the sons. So the daughters escape back to Greece from Egypt and they land up at the city of Argos and ask for succor. The young woman Io originally was a princess of Argos, and that's why they have come among the Argives, as the people from Argos like to call themselves. Gareth, can you tell me more about this and what you thought of it?
Well, I thought it was a terrific evening, and my summary of it would be a 2,500-year-old feminist play about a boatload of women who flee North Africa to avoid enforced marriage. And when you say it like that, apart from the 2,500 years old, it sounds a bit up to date, really. And I thought the combination of David Gregg's, as you say, earthy translation or adaptation, because he's worked from fragments of stories, really, and Ramin Gray's production which I thought was very thrilling. Brilliant choreography from Sasha Milovic-Davis. And then this terrifically atmospheric music on pipe and percussion by John Brown. I just thought the combination of those four things were just fantastic. I mean, they just came together to give this very exciting, a very thrilling kind of feel. It just comes alive. It comes alive for a modern audience. And even though we know it's a 2,500-year-old play, it doesn't feel anything like a 2,500-year-old play. And I've seen lots of community projects before, but I don't think I've ever seen a company of 24 people who have moved and sung that well. I think the quality of the vocals and the quality of the movement is extraordinary. And I just was captivated by the whole thing, really. But as you say, when the women get to Argos, the people give them asylum. And what's interesting is that the people vote democratically to give them asylum. You know, so there was degrees of democracy going back 2,500 years old, more so than in some countries today. But after that, the men folk tried to get their women back, and the people of Argos prevented them doing that. But then the play ends quite interestingly, and they then start questioning the value of migrants. And that was extraordinarily prescient, really. I just thought the whole combination was absolutely fascinating. So a great evening for me. Worth mentioning the opening. I mean, in the original Greek tragedies, they started plays, I understand, with a libation ceremony. And I've been going to theatre for a long time, but I've never been to a play that starts with a libation ceremony before. And what happens here, on the night I went, the chief executive of the London Borough of Southwark comes onto the stage and thanks all the people who made this possible, you know, the Arts Council, the London Borough, and so on, and the audience, and then pours wine over the stage, or whether it's wine, not beer, not so sure, and kind of replicates this ceremony that happened before the play was first produced 2,500 years ago. And that was the icing on the cake for me. I thought that was a brilliant idea, and I thought it was a wonderful way of engaging the local authority from whom these 50 or so people had come. But also, I just thought it was also a way of engaging the audience with the idea that this was a community piece. So it exceeded my expectations. I thought it was an exceptional evening. It's been touring. It started in Edinburgh and it's been touring, and it's really only got very little time in London, which is a great shame. You can understand why, with a community participation of 50 or so people, that it can't have such a long one. But I felt very pleased and very privileged to have caught it while it was here.
I thought it was rather special, a very impressive piece of work. This is the second David Gregg play that has used this format, this community format. I think it's much bigger now than the previous one.
Probably better. It was about the Norwegian massacre. And that had a community chorus as well, but on a different scale.
Yeah.
And it was really just a vocal addition rather than almost the whole play, which is what this is.
Yeah.
I mean, the chorus dominates this piece, which is a very different use of community, and a very brave use of community, but they were just great.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's much different here because the amount of choreography, the amount of work that these young people have clearly done, they're very together. The choreography is extraordinary. I mean, sometimes it did feel a little bit silly, but I think in the moment you don't mind that. It's just if you would step back a bit, then it might seem a little bit uncool, some of the things they did. But it was very cleverly done, and I think a very good look at it by David Gregg. I mean, I think you know, a very good look at the play and a very good version of the play by David Gregg. They, of course, mention that some of the fragments were found on an Egyptian rubbish heap. This is, I believe, Oxyrhynchus, which gave us the Trackers of Oxyrhynchus, which was revived at the Finborough earlier this year or the end of last year. So there is an echoing back to that. You know, we are very lucky to have found things, but we have lost so many ancient Greek plays. We have fragments from most of them. We know that some of the writers, and I think Aeschylus is one of them. I mean, Aeschylus wrote dozens of plays, and we probably have only about 8 of his plays. And, you know, same applies to Sophocles and Euripides and Aristophanes. They just weren't thought worthy of preserving in all of the disruptions towards the end of the Roman Empire. So it's a great pity, and we are very fortunate to see something like this, because Greek plays really do still live. I mean, they are very much about humanity in a way that, you know, some of the plays in between haven't been, and some of the plays haven't really represented people and haven't therefore lived on as much as the ancient Greek stuff, because it does capture real people and real events and things that simply haven't changed and are possibly not going to change. And that's not always a good thing, is it? It tends to be a rather, and certainly in this case, you know, we can see very obvious modern parallels, and it's still going on, and it's still fairly tragic, and it would have been absolutely fascinating to see the rest of the tetralogy. But I think the thing here is it's more about trying to marry off these 50 young women from that last speech that you hear of the play. One of the actors reads out the argument of Aphrodite, which is the only fragment we have from the fourth play. And at the end of this play, one of the arguments of the people from Argos, the Argives, is that they want these young women to get married, even if it's not getting married to their cousins. And I think that in ways, as well as being fresh and up to date, it also reminds us of what we've lost over the 2,500 years. And that is a bit of a pity, but this is certainly a very good evening out. And hopefully, just as the events went around touring, hopefully this will have a bit of a life on tour, and they will be able to pull together other community groups to act it out.
I think it's the combination of singing, chant, speech and movement. It's very interesting in this production because they appear, you know, 24 women appear to be moving as one. I mean, there is an incredible cohesiveness about the way they do it. And the other thing about it is that even though you're very conscious that this is a 2,500-year-old play, the movement has a bit of a contemporary feel to it. You know, I could have been in Sadler's Wells seeing a sort of modern dance company. And indeed, some of the chants, vocals, sometimes sounded like rap. So it built this incredible bridge between the two worlds, between the 2,500-year-old world and the present world. And I've seen lots of Greek tragedy, but I've not really sort of seen it that successfully, I don't think, from a point of view of the chorus. But then again, choruses are rarely this big, 24 in the main chorus, and then an equal number coming on towards the end. So, yes, a great, great experience.
We're now going to talk about Insignificance at the Arcola Theatre. This is just closed there. It is the play by Terry Johnson. It's directed here by David Mercatali. Terry Johnson wrote this play in 1982, and it was made into a film in 1985. It concerns four characters: the professor, an actress, a baseball player, and a senator. Many people say, well, that will be your Albert Einstein, your Marilyn Monroe, your Joe DiMaggio, and Joseph McCarthy. They're never actually named, but given the context and the way people are dressed and the way people act, you're pretty sure that that's who they are. But I think he's just, because Terry Johnson likes to not always adhere to historical reality, just calling them those four things helps him to be a lot more fictional. This is based kind of on real events. The breakdown of Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe's marriage did occur around about the time she was doing The 7 Year Itch, which is where we meet Marilyn Monroe in this, or we hear about the famous grating scene in The 7 Year Itch, where she stands over a subway grate, I think, and her skirt is blown up all around her. And it's a very significant scene in that film. But after all, in that film, she plays a character called The Girl, and she doesn't really have a name, which is something pointed out here. But we really start this play with the professor, who is in New York for a conference, a peace conference, but is under the control or under the thumb of the senator, based on Senator Joe McCarthy, who is interested in getting him to testify and is basically threatening that if he doesn't testify in the House Un-American Activities Committee findings, it's going to go bad for him. It's a bit of a threat that they can't exactly make, but Einstein was very pivotal in the development of nuclear weapons. Although he never actually took part in the Manhattan Project, which built the first atom bomb, he is the person who wrote to President Roosevelt saying an atom bomb is possible. And it was his sort of authority that the atom bomb was made. And of course, it's something that he deeply regretted later in life, as did Robert Oppenheimer, who was the man behind the atom bomb. It was something that he was very angry about because he was shocked by the destructive power. Nobody who developed the atom bomb was really ever aware of the destructive power. So Terry Johnson brings together these two ideas in this play. This is the breakdown of Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio's marriage, the scene from, we don't actually see the scene, but if you know the film and you see how the character playing the actress is dressed, you kind of know what she's just been done, and she kind of describes what she has done. In the film, it's much more explicit. The idea here is that Marilyn
Marilyn Monroe is fleeing her husband and fleeing the paparazzi, or the equivalent at the time, and breaks into the professor or Einstein's bedroom after the professor has been grilled a bit by the Senator Joe McCarthy. And they start discussing things. And in fact, Marilyn Monroe at one point discusses the theory of relativity. I think it's a special theory, although they call it something else here. And it's a really rather amusing setup with her explaining things and having learned things. And it's, you know, trying to say that this person with a slightly girlish voice was interested in clever people. And I mean, I don't know whether she was genuinely clever herself, but she's certainly somebody who gravitated towards clever people. And we get a slight hint of that with the professor saying that he went to see a play, and we see, you know, the play is The Crucible by Arthur Miller. I don't know whether it is historically accurate, but of course Arthur Miller was Marilyn Monroe's next husband, so there's a kind of idea that this is something she's attracted to, and she is rather turned off by Joe DiMaggio's stupidity. I don't know if Joe DiMaggio was that stupid in real life, but again, well, a lot of this is down to Terry Johnson's interpretation and Terry Johnson wishing to create this situation, which is possible but not exactly probable. The cast here at the Arcola is Alice Bailey Johnson as the actress, Simon Rouse as the professor, Tom Mannion as the senator, and Oliver Hembra as the ball player. And we have a design by Max Dory. I thought this production worked quite well. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this to a certain extent is that this play hasn't really been on in London for about 20 years, and I've certainly never seen it on stage before. And I've seen almost everything else that Terry Johnson's done. So I was rather interested to see how this played out, because I thought that the problem whenever people do Marilyn Monroe is that there is a standard way of doing Marilyn, and it doesn't always work. You know, the imitations are a bit samey, and they choose different Marilyns. I think that there are different ways of doing Marilyn Monroe, either as she's sort of this very plastic person that she is in one or two films. You think of things like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, just the beauty and the sort of the very still face, not really doing anything. But you also get the marvellous comedy in some other things, and the really personal stuff. I mean, things like Some Like It Hot, and to a certain extent The Misfits, or even The Prince and the Showgirl, where her ability as an actress kind of shines through a lot more than some of the other things, where she's almost this plastic version. And it was always a little bit worrying, because I think people tend to go towards a more plastic and tragic version of Marilyn rather than the real person who you might see behind the mask. And I mean, I think we get the real person here, and there is a hardness in the way that Alice Bailey Johnson does her Marilyn. I mean, she's not just this squeaky voice, but of course we get that. She's also something a lot more interesting as a person and an actress. I thought this production was done rather well. Very nice performances. It's always good to see Tom Mannion doing stuff. He's probably a bit too fit and a bit too big, a bit too tall to have been Joe McCarthy, who I don't think was quite that charming or pleasant, or you know, able to appear to be charming or pleasant or anything like that, which Tom Mannion does bring to this. I thought it was a decent production and very interesting to see it. What do you think, Paul?
Yes, I think one of the interesting things is probably the timing. This play kind of made Terry Johnson's name in the early 80s, when people were worried about a trigger-happy Ronald Reagan beginning bombing in 5 minutes, or whatever his joke was to warm up an audience. And I think now we also probably feel like we're almost in a similar time with our worries about what Trump will do next and so forth. The one thing, though, I would say, though, is that while this play I felt was particularly well acted and I really enjoyed the cast, it just seems like you kind of wonder, is there a deeper meaning to this piece? And actually, I wasn't that sure, having seen it all. For me, also, what made this interesting and topical was earlier this year, the uncovered footage of Marilyn Monroe filmed in New York City in the early hours of the morning for the film that is the topic of this play, and having her skirt lift up over almost over above her head to the whistles and catcalls of all sorts of strange and interesting men that were out and about in New York at that time. All of that, I think, you know, it does feel we've got more insights this year than probably we ever had about what transpired. In reality, it turned out that Joe DiMaggio beat up Marilyn Monroe and she had to be filmed the next day under quite heavy makeup due to the abuse that she suffered. But, you know, it's interesting here, I think, you know, is that the central message seems to be that bad things happen and, you know, you just get on with it. And in one way, I think the characterizations were just given a little bit too simplistic, I think, for my liking, to actually be an enjoyable play, because actually it isn't about abuse of power. Joe McCartney is almost presented as a decent family man rather than a crazy alcoholic that he was. It did feel more like it's a pop culture tribute act than a play in itself. But, you know, I think the actors worked material quite well. And I think Alice Bailey Johnson was particularly hilarious. I really enjoyed how she was recounting the theory of relativity with a, you know, essentially a box of tricks that she'd managed to, I guess we're led to believe, steal from the set. Having said that, this piece closed on Saturday at the Arcola, but it left me wondering, you know, it hasn't been revived since it was first produced, and perhaps there was a reason for that.
We're now going to talk about Mother Courage and Her Children at the Southwark Playhouse. This is Bertolt Brecht's play in a translation by Tony Kushner, who gave us Angels in America, of course, and Caroline Will Change next year, possibly. It is directed here by Hannah Chiswick and produced by Daniel Tarento. It has music by Duke Special and a costume and set design by Barney George. It stars Josie Lawrence as Mother Courage and has a cast including Laura Checkley, Ivy Corbin, Celeste Vesey, Rosalind Ford, Ben Fox, Jake Phillips Head, Shiv Jalota, Julian Moore Clark, Nuno Quimedo, David Shelley, and Phoebe Vigor. It is about a woman, Mother Courage, who is a trader during the 30 Years' War, which is a war that raged, I think, between about 1610 and 1640, somewhere around there, or maybe a bit later, which really rewrote the map of Europe so that we have most of the northern countries of Western Europe are Protestant, and most of the southern countries of Western Europe and the countries of Eastern Europe, well, places like Poland, are all Catholic. And it really, this war, this almost endless war, I mean, 30 years, is what created that divide, basically ethnically cleansed the people who didn't belong or didn't fit out of whichever country you were in. And this is about a woman who is a camp follower, who follows and moves between the sides, trying to trade, trying to look after her children. And we basically go through 10 or even 20 years of her life. But it's not really particularly about that. It is about individual scenes that Breck puts on it. It is based possibly on a real person, but at least on a contemporary play about a Mother Courage type figure. Paul, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, I think the importance, I guess, of this Brecht version of this story, which I believe has been around since probably the 30 Years' War, is to, you know, underscore the influence of capitalism and how war is an essential part of that and sort of driving workers and people into, you know, lives of poverty, but also driving them into war. And this particular translation, which was done by Tony Kushner, came out during the Iraq War, so it felt particularly relevant when it was first staged in New York, and then when it transferred into, I think it was 2009, to the National Theatre. And I remember that being incredibly epic, you know, even though this is meant to be epic theatre for those that know what that is. But it was a particularly epic staging of it. And, you know, I always wanted to, you know, wished I'd seen it more than once, actually, I remember. And so I was quite excited to get the opportunity to see this version at the Southwark Playhouse. And I think it's still the same thing, you know, war is hell, and, you know, but everybody has to scrape by and make a living. And so the whole premise is a series of scenes where Mother Courage and her children are following the soldiers all around Europe during the 30 Years' War, selling them bits and pieces and trying to make a living off that. And despite Mother Courage's endless optimism about potential for money and earning a living, you know, one by one, she loses everything that's closest to her heart. And the only thing that she's got left is the ability to chase a sail. And I think that's what's so fascinating about this piece. And, even this smaller scale version, I found myself completely enwrapped in, list watching the tale and, watching it unfold. And I think part of it is probably the choice to cast Josie Lawrence in the title role. She feels a lot more of a victim of circumstance here and comes across as, very likable and a bit funny too. So it was quite interesting to see the choice being made where this character tends to be a bit of an anti-hero as well. And I think it's interesting to keep this production quite simple, which is probably more in line with Brecht's original intentions. But I think there were some curious choices in both the staging at the Southwark Playhouse and perhaps some of the other choices in filling out the cast, that it tended to lose some of the sense of this epic spectacle. And also it didn't make things particularly flow as well as they could have. And I think that's setting the stage in the Traverse. Half the audience missed out on seeing the action because it was taking place behind them and didn't leave much room to other than move the cart on and off one end of the stage to the other, which did tend to make things a little bit repetitive. I think perhaps the Traverse staging has had its day at the Southwark Playhouse, and they do need to think of a bit more ability to make this, the configuration, a little bit more amenable to productions that probably don't benefit from it. I think Duke Special's music, which Duke Special performed it at the National Theatre, here it's performed by the cast members, and at times, because there's no amplification, it felt a little bit underpowered. And I think in general, you kind of lost the sense of the power of the music to comment on the action here for that reason. But, all told, for a piece that runs over 3 hours, I wasn't bored during it at all. So I think that's a testament to production working on some levels. But I just wish it probably staged a little bit better and had a bit more imagination behind how it was staged, and also things like the lighting and the choice of sound effects and the rest of the cast. Tim, what did you think?
It was a little bit problematic. I mean, I was very fearful of this play for many years until I saw a version with Diana Rigg at the National Theatre, because the only things I'd ever seen about it was the version that starred Brecht's wife, and basically you get this end scene where she's dragging her cart away alone for the final time, and Brecht's wife didn't have any teeth, so she took her false teeth out, so she looked really hollow-faced, and I thought, oh God, I don't think I want to see anything like that when I first heard about it. But actually, seeing it with Diana Rigg changed my mind a lot about this play, and I really quite enjoy this play as a play. I wasn't too sure about this production. I mean, Josie Lawrence, yeah, I think that she needed some interesting people to butt up against, and really strong performances to butt up against. I mean, it's not that they were bad, it's just that you need powerful people in there. You need, really strong characters and really strong characterizations in parts, especially, you've got mainly it's the cook, it's the prostitute, and it is the priest, who are sort of her constant companions apart from her children. And you want them to be very strong. But certainly with the soldiers here, you really couldn't tell who they were, what side they were on, or anything like that. It's pretty much a modern dress performance, although some of the things that Mother Courage wears have feelings back to, say, 18th century dress. It's not going back fully to the 17th century or the early 17th century, but you could see some elements of that. The problem with the cart is, the problem here a lot of the time was it's just too small a theatre to really do this justice, or at least, and the way they staged it, as you say, because you've got, I have to say, I didn't notice the problems with the Traverse staging, but obviously they are fairly obvious once you realise that, of course, all the people opposite me couldn't see all the action I was watching up above them, and that was a fairly big problem. And they had quite a few scenes set up there and wanted you to pay attention to what was going on up there, which I think is a bad mistake. The cart here really looked rather ordinary. I mean, the point about the whole cart is that it's supposed to track her fortunes. Now, obviously, they probably don't have the budget to really get a cart which is wonderful and covered and looks like a proper caravan, and then gets reduced down to a very bare bones thing. All you get is something that just has more or less boxes on it. I think almost doesn't change at all throughout the entire play, which is a bit of a problem for something that is in many ways so important. But I enjoyed Josie Lawrence's performance. I enjoyed quite a few of the other performances as well, but it is a rather underpowered production, I think, and it doesn't quite get it right. I have seen small-scale versions of this, including one with Catherine Hunter, which I thought worked slightly better as a production, but one of the things on Josie Lawrence's side is that she can certainly deliver a song. She's a very good singer and also a very good singing improviser, so I thought that a lot of that kind of worked, but yeah, she needed stronger other performances to bounce off, really, to make this good. And they needed a slightly better sort of production design and the production outlook.
Yes, and just on the cut, obviously, if you did have a full-size cut, that would make sight lines even worse for people needing to look across the traverse to see the action going on. So, yeah, it was a shame all told. But, you know, it was nice to see Josie Lawrence do this production. But, yeah, it could have been a lot more.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are, AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.